Well, it's a special day. We got the band back together. Kerry Haskell, visiting from New Orleans, not only in the studio, but producing, running the board, pushing the buttons, doing what he does. So good to have you here.
Yeah, it would have felt weird to not be on this side of the board. I had to move over here.
I understand completely. It feels oddly comfortable to be back on this side where I have no responsibility for anything other than just flapping my gums, and I can do that okay. Bruce Pratt in studio with us as well, and we thought, you know, what would make this a perfect gathering? There's only one person that would round out this troika of entertainment. That's our friend, actor, author, and storyteller, Stephen Tobolowsky, who joins us. Welcome, Stephen.
Hey, Rich. Love to everybody in Maine. Love to you all.
Right back at you.
You bet.
It's so good to have you here because you have been, you've been such a part of our Christmas so far. My goodness, every time I turn around, you're in a Christmas movie. We knew about the second Hallmark movie, which was wonderful, by the way. And then I didn't even know I was going to see you in Candy Cane Lane with Eddie Murphy and our friend Tim Simons.
That was a surprise too. But first of all, I love both of those movies for completely different reasons. It was the second time for Hallmark. It was the second time the gang got together, as you say, and it's so great to be with all those people again. It's like when everybody loves what they do and they're good at what they do and everybody works hard and nobody goofs off. It's just wonderful. It's just a wonderful feeling, and you go like, this is why I got into show business, to have this kind of fun with these kind of people. So, you know, Haul Out the Holly, Lit Up, that's part two. They're showing it now with Haul Out the Holly, which was part one, and I hope there's going to be a part three. We'll see, but it was just wonderful. And Candy Cane Lane was a really special I get the call from the casting people, the director, saying, we'd like you to play this part in Candy Cane Lane, to play the math teacher. I said, sure. They said, well, nothing's written yet, but we'll write something for you. And I go, okay. That's always nerve-wracking when that happens. So nothing was really written. And so I call up the director right like 24 hours before we're shooting. And I had his home number. I said, listen, I don't have a script yet. I don't know what I'm doing. Oh, don't worry. We're going to have something. I said, I understand. I understand you're going to have something good for me, but it kind of falls in the category of what I call virtue in the future. You know, there's so many good scripts in the future that exist, but what am I going to do in 24 hours? I have no idea. So anyway, they send me something the next morning, and I just thought, I can't do this. I don't know what this is that I'm saying. They had all of these jokes, funny jokes, you know, they had all these jokes, but like I had no idea who my character was or what I was doing or what. And I called the director and I said, I can't do it. Can't do the show. I said, I don't know what I'm doing. I don't know who I am. I said, I'm a math teacher. She says, we'll work it out on the set. We'll work it out on the set. So I show up on the set, having learned the lines they gave me. Eddie is there, you know, the cast is there, they're already, and I just start trying to do my part. Cameras, they're going to start on me. So the camera's going to start on me for the scene. And I just stop everybody in rehearsal. And I said, I'm sorry. I really am. Eddie, everybody, my apologies. I don't know what I'm doing. I don't know what I'm saying. I said, can I go back to acting class days and just say, you know, who I thought I was in this movie? And the director is finding this enormously amusing. And he comes up and he says, well, sure, Stephen, who do you think you are? I said, listen, I'm a math teacher. You know, math is a very important thing. And, you know, if Eddie's kid's not doing him math, it's going to hurt him for his future. Do you know, it was math that got us to the New World. It's math that got us to the moon. You know, you Vegas is all the probabilities of math. Our life is determined by math. And Eddie just looked at me and said, hey, just say that. So we made up the scene. on the spot. Wow. We made up this scene of talking about math, and I have no idea how it turned out. But let me tell you, it was delightful working with everybody on that show, too, because they were all so good. And when I went in to do looping, which, of course, you do at the end, where if there are any bits and pieces of your voice that weren't mic'd properly, you kind of redo those lines and have to try to fit your mouth. I was shocked at how great that movie looked. I was shocked, and because they had all the special effects in and all the Lords of Leaping and all of the amazing stuff in that movie. So it did not surprise me that it was the number one movie in the country. I was not surprised at all. Delightful, scary experience, but it all turned out okay.
Well, that's awesome.
I mean, it's such a small part in it, but it's the whole thing is just, Eddie is just hilarious.
He's great in it, yeah, and we love Tim Simons, who is a Mainer, who was so good in it as well. It was great.
Yeah, I just love that. That was a fluky, freaky event. It's strange times, Rich.
And,
strange times.
Your wife, Anne, has been directing a play that's got a Maine connection.
Absolutely. Monica Wood, the Half-Light. Oh, my gosh. So it was just a love letter to Monica out there. If she is listening, I saw the play 4 times, not because Anne directed it. I mean, I'll see a play once if Anne directs it, 4 times if it's exquisite. And I want to describe something to Monica of what happened at the end of Act 1. And this is, we had a very full house this last show we did, that they did. At the end of Act 1, there's a moment, and it almost never happens in theater. The lights go out at the end of Act 1, and there's a gasp in the audience of breath, of like, of this inhalation of breath, of like, lights come up, people are applauding, and nobody moves.
Wow.
Nobody in the audience moves, and all I see are people turning their head one to the other saying, this is beautiful, I love this, this is very, very good. These actors are very, very, it was poetry. It was beautiful. Just so many people love that show. It's just delicious.
Oh, that is wonderful to hear. And yeah, I feel like I was a part of that show in a very tiny, tiny way, but I'm happy to contribute.
Yes. Well, absolutely. It was not a very tiny way. And of course, the play takes place in Maine. Yeah, you know, and in it, the characters are reading a Maine newspaper.
Yeah.
And who did I contact? Who do I go to for the newspapers? I go, Rich, can you help me here? And I got to tell you, it was here the next day.
Wow.
And it played every the Sunday paper was right there for everybody to see.
Oh, that's wonderful. I see. I see Anne's been doing some baking too.
Oh, please, please. It's just happening. And I don't like her to share. I know it's a time of forgiving, but not right now. She made a collection of cookies. She made honey cookies with our honey from our beehive that we have in the back. Honey cookies. She made gingerbread today. She made cardamom cookies. Ooh. And
wow.
Oh, yeah. The house is full of cookies. It's full of cookies. And I am trying to measure my going up and down the stairs from the TV to the cookies. And I feel if I go up and down the stairs enough, it'll work the calories off.
Oh, I think that's how it works. Absolutely. A couple of flights of stairs, one cookie. I think that's good.
Yes. And I do have an absolute exclusive for you, Rich.
Oh, I love that.
I just found out before we went on the air.
Whoa, how about
absolutely.
This?
First, you were the first person to hear this.
All right, you heard it here first.
I just got an email that the movie I did with Chris Pine, Pool Man, like a couple, like at the beginning of the pandemic, Danny DeVito, Annette Bening, Jennifer Jason Lee, John Ortiz, and me, and Chris Chris is in it and he directed it. This film was finished about a few months ago when we saw it at Chris's agency at CAA. I watched this movie from beginning to end. It is wacky. It is weird. It is funny. The movie ended. I looked at Ann. Ann looked at me, and she said, I loved it. I said, I could sit and watch this whole movie again. Anyway, didn't hear anything about the movie until a few minutes ago.
Oh.
And I just heard from the producers it's got a distributor. And so it will be picked up, and it'll be out there. So Pool Man, it is a crazy, goofy movie. I was contacted by my agent saying that Chris wants to talk to you about doing this movie. Chris Pine wants to talk to you about doing this movie. I said, well, can I read the script? And I looked at the script, and the part they wanted me to read for was Stephen Togarowski. And I'm going, what? Excuse me? What? I'm auditioning for this part? So, you know, I talked with Chris. Everything was on Zoom, like everything is now with the pandemic, on Zoom. And then my agent called me a week later and said, Stephen, I've got good news for you. You're still in the running.
No,
I'm still in the running for Stephen Togarowski. But I, anyway, nailed the part of Stephen Togarowski, and it'll be out there for people to see, hopefully very soon.
Well, that's exciting. And we'll be looking for that.
That's a stellar cast.
Yeah, Pool Man. And it's kind of a comedy, but it's kind of a dystopian world science fiction sort of thing where Chris plays a pool man in Los Angeles in the future where there is no water. So all the pools are empty, and he keeps having these hallucinogenic dreams. And as you meet these strange characters he encounters on his way, it's like an Altman movie, something like that. And what happens is the images of his dream eventually become true, and we, the audience, begin to see them happening, and they start to tell another story. Wow. So it's kind of very interesting, very wacky film. A lot of laughs in it.
And what kind of a character is Stephen Togarowski?
Well, I can't tell you too much because it's a bit of a surprise.
Okay, all right.
But I can tell you this, that I play the head of the Los Angeles City Council, and Chris has business with the Los Angeles City Council, and I am a rabbi and head of the council, and Chris suspects that there's something not right with me, and so he decides to follow me, and that's where things take a very strange turn.
All right, we'll be looking for Pool Man. Yeah. Stephen Togarowski with us, not Togarowski, with us here on Dante. You mentioned Altman. You've worked with everybody in the business. Did you ever work with Robert Altman?
I hate to tell you this. My old girlfriend, Beth Henley, she wrote Crimes of the Heart, which I think you just did at the theater there. The theater there. And Beth won the Pulitzer Prize, first play right out of the gate. Who knew? You know, who knew she was a genius? Anyway, we were out in Topanga. I think we were smoking some sort of marijuana of some sort. We were all loaded, and we were reading Beth's new play. And we all had to relieve ourselves, and what you did in Topanga was you just go out and do so in the bushes around whosever house you're unfortunate enough to be doing the reading. So I go out, and I am eating a snack and peeing on a bush, and who comes next to me? Robert Altman. Robert Altman stands next to me, and he says, we're either going to kill this bush or it's going to be luscious and magnificent. And I said, Mr. Altman, I don't think anything good is going to come of this. And he optioned Beth's play to turn it into a movie. And he had it optioned for a few years. And then it's one of those things in Hollywood that just kind of went by the wayside.
Hmm.
I think we ended up doing her play on Broadway before Robert Altman ended up doing that. But he ended up doing a lot of other great movies. You never know. but we hung out with him for a while at that period of time. He was a very joyous fellow.
Now, was this one of the parties where you were unclothed? Because I know that way you talk about that in your book.
There were parties where I was unclothed, but not the one in Topanga. This is the party. This is the party where it was Christmas. Well, it is the Christmas time of year, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
So this is the party. We're all in the living room listening to Bob Dylan's Blood on the Tracks. Just came out, so that'll date it. And Joe came out of the kitchen, says, Merry Christmas to everyone. I just want to tell you, your Christmas gift has come a little early because I put LSD in all of your coffees.
Oh, no.
Now I'm looking at my empty mug and I'm going, what? Wait a minute. Wait, time out. You got to give us a heads up with this one, Joe. Anyway, I started to feel like my head was exploding. And I go back to talk to our hostess, and she was like counting jelly jars in the kitchen. And she's going like, oh, that's so cool. You're rushing. That's, you know, the blood just buzzing. I said, well, can I die? She says, what you need to do is be in a very cool, dark place, which is the toilet at the end of the hall. Why don't you go down and wrap around the toilet, base of the toilet? And at this point, I could no longer walk. So I'm crawling on all fours, and I go back to the toilet, and she wraps a blue towel around my neck. Now, you stay back here, and I'm going to shut this door, and then you're going to feel a whole lot better. So she shut the door, and I don't know how long I was in there, but at one point I leave. I walk down the hall. I take a right turn and go outside, and there's the dog of the house, Manny Moore, who is kind of a shepherd mix dog. And I look at Manny, and I'm suddenly filled with sort of admiration. And I go, Manny, you are so mighty. You are so strong. You look out into this night, and I know you are a powerful hunter. And he goes, Stephen, you have no idea what you're talking about. And Manny's like, talk about. I said, what do you mean, Manny? He says, Stephen, I have no power. I mean, you look out at the night and you see mystery, but I have senses more keen than you. I can see that there's a coyote behind that tree waiting for me just to go a little too far. I know that there are dangers here that you could only perceive that I know. And so I came up with a rule that whenever you have too much to drink, too much to smoke, or if somebody puts LSD in your coffee, the basic rule of thumb, if the dog talks to you, listen to the dog. That's a rule.
That's sage advice right there.
A rule to live by right there.
Now, Kara, you just made the trip back here to Maine from New Orleans, and once again, Stephen accompanied you on your journey.
Yeah, you've become my late night driving companion. So we do the drive from New Orleans to Maine, Maine to New Orleans in one shot. We don't stop at a hotel. So when we hit the late night hours, I'm the driver, Loretta's sleeping, and so I put on Tobolowsky Files and listen to you for 5-6 hours of driving. And this, I started this with the first episode of the COVID season, which includes one of my favorites of all time. The episode where you talk about the fifth dimension as narrative as the fifth dimension. Just a wonderful, wonderful episode of the Tobolowsky Files.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I keep getting kind of letters from all over the world. Well, not letters anymore, emails of people that not making a trip from New Orleans to Maine, but something happening in their life like that, you know, where they're stuck somewhere and they plug into the Tobolowsky Files and find something. I found something not long ago, and I'm looking at it right here, and you'll love this, Carrie. So anyway, I started doing the Tobolowsky Files when I broke my neck, right in 2008. Mm-hmm. And it was David Chen at Harvard, he was a student at Harvard at the time, who said, can we do stories? And so I started writing these stories, and David started recording them, just like we're doing this broadcast now. So I created a document in which I could write down ideas for stories that maybe could be in the podcast, and I lost the document. I had no idea where it went. So I was doing a search on my computer this week for some keyword of something, and the document came up. It was written in 2008, January 7th, 2008. It is 23 pages long, and it has hundreds of story bits, story pieces for what became the Tobolowsky files. Mm. And some of these things I didn't even remember. I didn't even remember in my life. I had forgotten them. Here's one which I don't think made it into the Tobolowsky files. It may have, but it cracked me up. And it was back when I was single. And I went to New York and I met my friend from college, Greg Grove, and we decided we would see if we could buy drinks for ladies at bars. we were going to step out and we were going to see if we could make time with anyone and how that would be. So the first thing we did is we went to the White Horse. I think that was the one where Dylan Thomas drank himself to death, right? The White Horse Tavern. Greg and I went in and I sat down and he met a lady. I met a lady, go, hello, how are you? Can I get you a drink? Yo, yes, thank you. And she says, so what do you do? So at this place, I said, actually, I'm a dermatologist. I live in New Jersey and I come into town maybe 3 days a week. And she was fascinated. And she said, well, what's it like being a dermatologist? And I said, I love it. I love it. You know, first of all, it's a good practice because there's always going to be acne. There are always going to be warts. I rarely have to see any cancer or anything that's terrible. And, you know, we have a little saying, the dermatologist, that you either moisten it or you dry it up. And either one of those kind of works. And I make enough money to where I come into town and 3 days a week, I either go to the opera, I go to the museums or whatever. And she starts writing down her phone number. And she says, well, if you ever need any company. And I'm going, I go to Greg. I'm going like, we struck gold. The next place we went to was McHale's on 42nd Street. So went into McHale's. We met two ladies. We sat at the bar. I have a drink. She says, so what do you do? And I said, well, right now I'm a delivery boy. Well, delivery, actually, I'm an actor. I'm an actor and I'm trying to get enough money for headshot pictures, get a resume together. Hopefully I'll get an agent. But right now I deliver and I deliver usually late at night. I have the late night shift. So I'm like 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. I'm delivering packages. And she goes, oh God, why do I meet all of the losers? It's just my advice to everyone in your audience, go with dermatology. If you really are caught up and you want to impress someone, go with dermatology.
You had her in moisten, I think. That was
You dry it up or you moisten it.
I have a great White Horse story that's really there. I was in there one night when I was playing music in the Village, and I was sitting with a group of friends, and they were trying to pick up this young woman. One of them was, and a guy looks at her and he pushes a shot over what she's drinking and says, "This will put hair on your chest." To which she opens her shirt and says, "I've got hair on my chest."
Oh, man.
And way more than I have, even now in my old age. And I just remember sitting there saying, that's why Dylan Thomas got so drunk here, because this is who we're running into.
The White Horse. But I got to say, it's, you know, going to those, I wonder if they're still there, those classic bars. Do you know? Have you been to New York lately?
Yeah, last time I was in New York, there were. There's a restaurant called Bistro Les Amis, which I love, and we've been going to for 20 years down on the Lower East Side. We went through the Village and walked around, and there seemed to be a lot of them there. The White Horse, I believe, is still there, but I haven't been that far west in the Village in a while, but going back soon. So that was one of my favorite bars.
My favorite in New York was always McAleer's on like 80th and Amsterdam around there. And I found out that they no longer exist. Yeah. And it was like it was a stomping ground when I was doing Broadway. I was doing mornings at 7 there for a year. It was so successful. But afterwards, we all go back to McAleer's and I hear it is no more. And that is part of the problem with the present is that a lot of times it's unrecognizable. Our past has instructed us what to look for and it ain't there anymore. Mm-hmm. And this is just a sad thing to note. CBS Radford, the studio where I did Seinfeld and I did several shows, gone. CBS Radford's gone. There is an article in the paper that Paramount is being sold.
Wow.
There was another article that maybe Warner Brothers is going to move to Texas. So it's like the world that I knew, that acting world that I knew, is changing rapidly. And so we'll see what happens at the end of this COVID trail.
Yeah, the music scene in the Village, which is where I was really uptown, but changed so radically that now people don't go to New York to become folk singers, and that's what you used to do. That was where you got heard. That's where you got seen, whether it was the Bitter End or whether you were at Gertie's Folk City or any of those places. And they're almost all gone. I mean, I loved playing in those places. And the dugout and the back fence and all them, but I can't imagine what it'd be like without them. I don't know if I'd want to be in the Village anymore. And I love the Village.
Yeah, I used to live with friends on McDougal.
237 West 11th for me.
Yeah, McDougal, like West 4th, right there by Washington Square.
The kettle and of fish.
I just can't imagine. Mm.
Stephen, before we let you go, speaking of things that are no longer around, we lost the great Norman Lear recently.
Yes.
And I know you have a wonderful story about Norman. Could you share that with us again?
I have so many. Can I have a hint?
I'm thinking of when you had...
Was it when...
I think it was when you were going to be doing One Day at a Time, and you explained to him that you had met him
many years
ago.
Yes, there. On my audition for One Day at a Time, it's to play Dr. Berkowitz. Again, it's the same thing like Candy Cane Lane. They never gave the scripts out. So, nobody knew what it was. I didn't know who I was on the show at all. Nothing. And so you have every character actor that I ever knew in Hollywood pacing the hallway looking like a doctor. Either they're wearing lab coats or they got something to look. And me, I'm just dressed like the schlub I am, just my blue jeans and my T-shirt or what, nothing. I walk in and there is Norman. And I walk up to Norman and I said, "You don't know this, but when I first arrived to Los Angeles, I wrote to Jane Murray, and Norman gets all verklempt, he gets all kind of, Jane, that was his casting director. She did Mary Hartman. She did everything. She did all of his shows. I wrote a letter to her because it was the only address of a casting person I had. And I said, I'm from Texas. If there's anything. And Norman, the first job I got in town was to be an extra on Mary Hartman. A friend of mine from my neighborhood in Oak Cliff, Texas, Kay Callen. And Norman gets all verklempt again. Kay. She was on the original One Day at a Time. She invited me to see One Day at a Time, and your show was the first live TV show I saw. And Kay introduced me to you backstage. And you were the first really important person in show business that I ever met. You. And then I went and did my audition. I got the part. And the thing I thought you were going to say, which is Norman Lear adjacent, because it's the kind of guy he is. When we were doing the climax of season two for One Day at a Time, Rita Moreno is in a coma. And we're all coming up and telling her how much we love her. It was a very difficult show to do and a difficult show to rehearse. And we were going to have to work on Yom Kippur. The holiest day of the Jewish year, not supposed to work, not supposed to eat, not supposed to do anything. So all the people came, the execs came to me and said, Stephen, will you work? Will you work with us on this show, or are you going to take that day off? And I said, I'll rehearse because we need to do the show. We need to do the show. Norman came to the rehearsal, and he took me aside. And while they were rehearsing on one set, Norman brings me to the living room set, and he sits me down on the couch, and he said, besides, thank you for being here today, he said, I want to tell you about my Yom Kippurs when I was a child. And Norman did. And then he said, tell me about yours. And so we sat on the couch and talked for about 45 minutes about Yom Kippur and what it meant to us in our lives. And it was one of the holiest days of the year I ever had. And Norman always meant so much to me. And dear, dear man. And he was such a supporter of Dangerous Animals Club and my writing, such a supporter of the podcast. I love him. And we were all told that he wasn't going to make it through the night. And all of us just kind of huddled together. And, you know, we expressed our grievance to his wife and said, we'll be quiet. We're not going to say anything. We're not going to do anything. But know that we all are with you and we love you. There's nobody like him. Nobody. Nobody has been like him. Amazing man.
Absolutely. Well, Stephen, it is always a treat for us to talk with you. Thank you for making our little reunion complete this afternoon.
Oh, I love being in Maine, even if it's there just virtually, and especially with that Carrie character there over there. I love it.
Well, thank you so much. Our best to Ann.
Hope
you get some good granddad time over the holidays.
Yeah, we definitely are. Most assuredly are.
We drink to you, Stephen. Thank you much.
Yes,
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you.
Stephen Tobolowsky with us here on Downtown.